Welcome to a psychodelicious conversation on mental health issues and trends from two local mental health professionals in the greater Lansing area. I'm Michael Stratton, LMSW.
And I'm Morgan Bowen, DNP, PMHNP, and we're here to provide you with a deep dive into the human experience of consciousness and beyond. Our aim is to be educational and entertaining, so just kick back and open your ears and your minds.
Hey, I'm Michael Stratton.
And I'm Morgan Bowen.
And we are here talking about schizophrenia, and I was just brought up to current date. I made a statement in the first section of this where I called patients schizophrenics, and Morgan pointed out to me that it's not schizophrenics. That's not the term to be used anymore. It's people with schizophrenia, which makes sense. They do the same thing with alcoholism these days, where they've removed that from the DSM. They don't call people alcoholics anymore. They don't even use the term alcoholism. They use substance use disorder.
Alcohol use disorder.
Mild, moderate. You know, whatever.
And why is it done that way?
Well, it's kind of a pejorative term. It's kind of a judgmental term. Mm-hmm. And it's a strong identification, like, glad to meet you. I'm schizophrenic. Glad to meet you. I'm alcoholic. Versus right. like, this is who I am and I have this condition.
Yeah. So it doesn't define the person.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's what we're talking about in part in this hour as well, or this half hour or this 27 minutes.
Well, we wanted to talk first about a creature in your life.
Well, this is going to get, this is how we're finally going to get mail.
Yeah.
Is that I have a feral cat that lives on our porch.
You live in Lansing. You live in the city.
We have a nice porch. And we have cats that come up on our porch occasionally, but this one.
Enclosed porch or open?
No, it's an open porch. And so this one, she's got this big fur coat. We call her Thundercat. She's a beautiful cat. And she would just be hanging around a lot. And as the weather changed, I bought one of these kind of tent houses for her and set it up. She didn't go into it for the longest time, but finally she did. And it's got a heated pad. We just plugged it in and it would be a heated pad. And when it gets to these really, really super cold nights, and I feel good that she had a heated pad, and we just found out that the heated pad isn't working. So she's been out there in the cold. At least she has some shelter.
She got some shelter.
Yeah. She got some shelter, but I feel bad about it.
Do you have straw or something? Is there anything
to insulate? There's no straw right now, no. But I'm looking for feedback from the listeners. So they should look up Psychodelicious Conversation and send us suggestions. By the time it gets to us, it'll be springtime, though.
By the time they finish writing out a psychodelicious conversation, which is the email, by the way, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
That's it. That's the one. And we're waiting for.
That's why you guys hire me.
That's right. That's
good. We might have to hire a shorter email address, but. How do you know that it wasn't working? Has it not been working the whole time or
finally
it went out?
Well, we don't know if it has not been working the whole time or not. The thing is, when we step out, because we bring out food and water for her every morning. I do.
Do you know it's a her?
We're pretty sure.
Yeah.
That's our fantasy. Anyway, that's... What? Okay. Why the faces?
I don't know. I'm not sure.
I feel more protected.
Do you want a cat family?
It was an odd way to describe it. It just was odd.
Anyway. Well, I was wondering if she had been pregnant or you'd seen.
Fixed because she's got a clipped ear.
Oh, she does. She has a clipped ear.
So that's a sign that a feral cat has been fixed and declawed. So she's helpless out in the world.
Oh, important piece.
That's not always
good, I don't think.
We feel more protective of her because of that. Anyway, we tried to call her they, them for a while, but it just didn't fit.
Yeah.
Anyway, what was the question? How did we know that the heating pad didn't work?
Yep.
The heating pad, my wife went out and she said, I'm going to put my hand inside the house just to feel it, see how warm it is, and realized it was cold in there.
Freezing
and
cold.
And it was like, that's not working at all.
Well, but the warmth of the cat, like when they're in the enclosed space, right, they can kind of curl up and then their body heat heats up the space.
I would
much more than we could, yes.
Yeah. She does have that big fur coat, which is the, I think. The
now, would you ever think about letting this cat into your house?
I've tried. I've left the door open. I've said, come on in, come on in.
You have no pets?
We have no pets currently. Mm. And that's the other thing that people, if they want to
Well, it kind of, you know, may segue a little bit into our conversation of treatment with schizophrenia.
Oh, right. We got that going on.
Because people and cats have a right to, you know, self-determination. They can decide if they would like to come in. Yeah. I mean, you're thinking, hey, come into my really warm house. It's great in here. We're going to take care of you. The fantasy is real. And that cat says, no way. Yeah. I don't want anything to do with that.
That's right.
And it's hard for you to understand why that cat is not coming into your house. But
see, people,
they decide anyway.
People can refuse treatment. And someone who has schizophrenia can also refuse
treatment. And it's very frustrating sometimes for us as clinicians, as well as family and, you know, kind of maybe the community at large. Why would somebody not engage with treatment if there is a treatment? Why are they not participating in it? Wouldn't things overall just be better if they did?
I'm curious. We probably should have talked about it in the first part, but generally in your experience, do you find that folks with schizophrenia are aware that they have it?
Yes. Well, maybe not in an acceptance sort of way, because there are times in which they think people are lying to them and it's a conspiracy. Mm-hmm. And
that's why I was wondering.
But there are people that do. A lot of times the goal of the trajectory of treatment, because, you know, it's going to be lifelong if somebody has, you know, schizophrenia. So the goal is to really establish really good treatment relationships, you know, really good relationships with their doctor or their nurse practitioner or their therapist, so that you can, you know, continue a relationship throughout all the phases. So if somebody is able to engage with treatment, has a good experience, recognizes that the treatment is helpful for them, then there's a better chance that they are going to accept the, you know, that they do have an illness.
Mm. Okay.
So I've seen it both ways. I've seen people who come into the hospital, this is when I was working in the hospital, who know that they're moving into because it's not that they're, you know, it's not that the person is completely psychotic all the time. There's ebbs and flows to times in which it's more serious than other times. So if somebody's moving into a more acute episode, meaning like they're feeling like their illness is getting worse, there are some people who will present and they'll come to the hospital. They'll come to the doctor and say, I think I need to be in the hospital. I think my meds aren't working or something's happening. Mm.
Okay.
And a lot of the homeless population, a lot of the unhoused population, there's a significant amount of mental illness among the unhoused population. And so there is a lot of schizophrenia. And so people who would rather, you know, live in that situation without treatment because they just don't feel like they need it or that they, that they're sick or that there's really anything wrong with them.
Hmm. Yeah, yeah. It's a difficult thing. And when I was working more directly with mentally ill folks, there was a lot more services available. So there was a lot more housing available. There was kind of wraparound services for people in mental health. You know, I was thinking too of the progression, you know, when someone gets in the door for treatment, you know, and you can start to use some medication that helps lessen the hallucinations, helps them relax a little bit, helps them to think more clearly. All of those things kind of help a person get stabilized. And then if they can establish relationships with someone in the helping profession and they can do some family therapy and some other things in terms of linking them with community services of some kind, their life can improve. They can get to the point where maybe they will be able to hold a job or, you know, function at the job that maybe they have already, mm-hmm. you know, all of those kinds of things. There's a number of different kinds of treatment modalities that actually do work in therapy with people who have schizophrenia. So CBT in terms mm-hmm. of helping a person mm-hmm. do problem solving, helping a person with relaxation techniques, help a person improve in terms of their self-esteem, you know, some of that negative self-talk that a person does, they can start identifying that. And the other one is ACT, mm-hmm. acceptance and commitment therapy, which when it started, they used populations of people that had a pretty severe mental illness profile, often people who had schizophrenia. And it was interesting because part of where they came from was the idea of like, we don't know how well we can work with your symptoms, but we can help you accept your symptoms. And given that you have that, what are your values and what do you want to spend your life on? What are you doing? When you're doing something and you're really having a great time doing it and you're enjoying it, what is that? And when I went through the training for ACT, that's what they would focus on. They showed examples of that, of people who said, you know, it's not that my symptoms are that much better, but I'm spending a lot more time enjoying my life because I'm spending it with these people, or I'm doing my artwork, or I'm building things, and I love to build things. And, you know, they're just doing more things that they're committed to doing. And that can help, too. Because I think there was probably a period of time when people didn't think of therapy and schizophrenia as things that they didn't see it as very treatable, but it's very treatable, as it turns out.
It is. It is treatable. And there's a number of different programs and approaches, and it, you know, it kind of depends on what's available in the person's area. Some, you know, some places that have really great mental health systems, maybe connected to a university or, you know, a hospital, has a lot of innovative programs to really both work with the person in terms of like medications. The medication treatment is fairly, I don't want to say routine, but we have a group of medications that are, you know, usually effective to some extent.
What's being used these days? What are they?
Second generation antipsychotics, and those include things like Abilify, Zyprexa.
Do they still use Thorazine and that kind
Invega
of stuff?
Invega and Risperdal. No, not so much. Thorazine is a first generation, and so used like a lot, and then in Haldol as well. Haldol. You do see it. I mean, you still see it used, particularly in treatment-resistant cases, but they have a lot of side effects. The first generations do. All of the medications have side effects, but the first generations tend to be more significant.
The tardive dyskinesia.
Yeah, yeah.
You used to see people who would have kind of a twitchiness or a strange, you know, kind of facial.
It's like an involuntary kind of facial movement that is persistent, rhythmic, and what's the word? It doesn't go away. It stays around.
Yeah. Chronic.
Yeah. So there's ways to administer the medication with an injection where the person just needs the medication injection once a month, or sometimes once every 2 months or 3 months. So that is also a big component of treatment. And a lot of that is, you know, through community mental health, as opposed to like what we do in the outpatient world. It's usually more coordinated through CMH, or it's more easily coordinated through CMH.
Is it always chronic, though? I mean, if you're schizophrenic or if you have schizophrenia, you have those symptoms, is it always chronic?
If it's true, I'm doing air quotes here, like, you know, a true schizophrenia develops at the age 17 to, you know, 24, has both the hallucinations and or the delusions, as well as what is called the negative symptoms, which are poor grooming, you know, oftentimes like the cognition can vary, like the thinking can be a little bit more rigid or less, you know, the learning abilities and things are not as high. So in cases that have the combination of all of those things, it tends to be chronic and lifelong.
So another question I have is, what would a person rule out? I mean, what other symptoms might be similar? And I'm wondering about people, for instance, who might experience dissociative states, then might come to the conclusion like, oh my gosh, I must have schizophrenia because I'm having this dissociative state where I feel like I'm just practically out of body, or I found myself walking for several blocks. I had no idea where I was.
Yes. Well, the first thing we always look at, I mean, if somebody's coming in to do, you know, like an evaluation, they would, you know, do some type of CT of the head or a brain scan to see if there's any type of brain tumor or brain mass that could be. So if you have a mass in the head, it can, in your brain, it can mimic the symptoms. So that is one of the big rule outs. If somebody out there is thinking that maybe they have schizophrenia, a dissociative state is, you know, that feeling of out of body, that feeling of experience is not really in line with like a psychotic. Like the psychosis is really seeing things, hearing things that are persistent, that are happening on a regular basis. Sometimes people will describe somebody who does not necessarily have a classic psychotic illness will, you know, describe like seeing a shadowy figure at the end of their bed. Sometimes people who experience sleep paralysis, where they kind of wake up and they're half awake and they're kind of paralyzed and they have a really scary experience. some people would describe that as a psychotic thing, but it's really not in the same realm as, you know, something that's happening daily or frequently and is more consistent and impactful on the person's day to day.
I a couple of different times I've worked with people who had really pretty severe OCD, you know, obsessive compulsive disorder. And one of the individuals I was working with, part of their obsession was, I have this condition. I have this condition. I have this condition. They were really pretty sure there was something really wrong with them. And one of the things they would latch on to was, I have schizophrenia. I know I'm going crazy. That's what this feels like. And I would ask, do you hear things that other people don't hear? Mm-hmm. Do you have this kind of thought, this kind of thought? And they didn't, but they just had the fear of that. And Yeah,
it's a component, I would say, of like illness, anxiety disorder, which is, very related to kind of an obsessional thought that I have, you know, a hypochondria. It is hypochondria when a person thinks that they may have X, Y, or Z. And then I think it speaks to just the cultural awareness of this really severe illness called schizophrenia that is, you know, the person is, you know, kind of there's this idea that the person is totally crazy and they're going to get locked up in, you know, the hospital forever and ever. And so for somebody that has like a anxiety disorder related to health, like that is very much a, you know, could be a huge fear of theirs. Well,
the movie Psycho. You know, where, you know,
Norman Bates,
Norman Bates dresses up as, I'm going to give the movie away. So
it's
spoiler alert.
It's
70 years old.
Yeah, it's 40 years later or whatever.
Shoot, I was going to watch that
50,
tonight.
60, 70?
Yeah. Norman Bates dresses up as his dead mother and then kills women in the shower, or one particular woman. It's pretty
that was
close.
The sound. You might have.
There's somebody out there going, I'm not going to watch that movie now.
It's such a good movie.
But it is a great movie. It's
classic.
It's terrifying. It's terrifying. But you know, that's that idea of someone being psycho is that they're a killer or psycho killer. Mm-hmm. You know, with David Byrne and the Talking Heads doing that. You know, people that are psychotic rarely are murderous kinds of people.
No, they're not. And there are times in which, you know, somebody is, you know, potentially a danger to others, but that is pretty rare. Mm-hmm. And it's much more often, like we talked about in the previous episode, that a person is a danger to themselves because they just are so plagued and tortured by the experiences that they have that they just don't want to. Or there are times where the, you know, voices are telling them to hurt themselves. So it's much more common that there's self-directed violence.
I think it's good that you guys state that because I think the movies really do portray it the other way around.
Yeah.
And most anybody, you know, like I said, most of my experience is going to be from movies. Mm-hmm. I have run into that now that I think about it. I felt uncomfortable, but I didn't feel threatened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right.
Yeah, there is something unsettling. I mean, deeply unsettling to see somebody who just appear, you know, they're gesticulating and talking to themselves and disheveled. And I think it's unsettling for most of us to see that. And I think that's a common thing. But the sense that somebody is a danger to them, I think, is very much a story that's told to us. I mean, that's a cultural projection. It's an othering. I mean, you know, there's lots of examples of cultural scapegoats that we have that, you know, we kind of target our fears on.
They say it's like 1% of the general population has schizophrenia,
which is a very low percentage,
but a high number at the same time.
Yeah.
There used to be, types of schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. Do they still have that? Like they used to call hebephrenics and
yes, there is, but less so than there used to be. There's catatonic schizophrenia. There's a schizophrenia catatonic type. In the world of psychiatry, there is the ability to specify, but we don't focus in current diagnosis as much on the types as they used to.
Yeah.
But the two big ones, I guess, that come to mind are when there's an element of catatonia. So that's a completely still state. The person is often in a rigid or a position that they don't move from for long periods of time, days, sometimes lots longer than that. So that does happen. Then there's paranoid schizophrenia. And now it's called schizophrenia, I think paranoia type or in the diagnosis. So that's where there's a fear of, you know, that somebody's after them or that people are out to get them. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. My big thing, I loved working as a nurse with people with serious mental illness because there's a lot of joy. There's, I mean, there's a very unique perspective that people with mental illness bring, and it's a shade of the human experience. I mean, it's definitely a part of the human experience. And if you are able to move beyond the kind of fear that you or I or whoever may have, or the just that otherness that they're, you know, they're so bizarre. I don't want to be around them. I don't want, you know, mm-hmm. I want them to stay over here and me to be over here. If you can bridge that, then you can really connect with just a very interesting way of thinking, a different experience that has a vibrancy, very often very artistic, very thoughtful. And I just really enjoyed that. I really, really enjoyed that.
That matches my experience, too. When I was working with people with schizophrenia, they were, by and large, like over well over 90% enjoyable people to work with and were very creative, sometimes very, very funny, very interesting senses of humor, often coming in really, really scared. But as time went on and you got to know them better and they relaxed, you would see that side of them. And they were a lot of fun and often.
Yeah, yeah. And one other thing.
Very endearing.
So there is a book by a woman with schizophrenia. It's called The Center Cannot Hold, which is the quote of a very famous poet that I cannot remember. Maybe Dedalian can look up this book because I also can't remember her name. She is a professor of law. She's a lawyer and a professor of law. I know she was at UCLA for a long time.
Did she do a TED Talk?
I think she does do a TED Talk. Yeah, I can picture her.
Was it Ellen Sachs?
Yep, Ellen Sachs. She has a wonderful book that is a memoir of her experience, her journey with schizophrenia. Very smart woman. She grew up in Florida. She went to one of the Ivies. I can't remember which. Princeton, something like that. Very smart. She went to law school, all of which her illness developed as she was doing this.
Yeah.
Became a lawyer and is a huge advocate for the rights of persons with mental illness, especially as it relates to restraint, use of restraint.
You also mentioned NAMI in the first section of this, and NAMI is the National Association for Mental Illness,
mm-hmm.
Family-oriented support system for people, family members, and also incorporating folks that have the mental illness themselves. And it's a great source for that. They hired me a number of years ago to do a motivational interviewing training. And what I found out by doing that is that, you know, just empathy is something that works really, really well. And the ability to sidestep conflict, to roll with resistance, to do that kind of thing really worked well with folks that have schizophrenia.
And it's really, they have a family program for, especially for families with people with serious mental illness. There's a lot of education and kind of trying to understand their experience as well as logistics of, you know, what if the person is not in treatment and not taking their medication and, you know, how do we manage that? Maybe set up some boundaries, you know, things like that, like practical. And there's a support element of families, you know, in groups where they, you know, they meet, they mentor other families. The illness impacts a huge amount of people in the network of the person. So the family needs support too.
Yeah. A Psychodelicious conversation is meant for educational and entertainment purposes only. It is no substitute for therapy and should not be treated as such. If you feel a need for real therapy, you should consult your local provider, Google therapy or therapists in your area, check with community mental health, or a suicide hotline if you are feeling suicidal.
Mike and Morgan welcome your questions, feedback, or dilemmas. Feel free to send us an email at apsychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com. That is apsychodelicious, psychodeliciousconversation@gmail.com.
The views expressed on this podcast are solely the opinions of Mike Stratton and Morgan Bowen and do not reflect the views or opinions of any site broadcasting this podcast. Replication of this podcast without written permission is strictly prohibited. sharing the voices of Lansing Community College. Visit us at lccconnect.org.
LCC.
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
The LCC Library empowers the Lansing community to learn, teach, and discover. Located on the second and third floors of the Technology and Learning Center at the corner of Capitol and Shiawassee on LCC's downtown campus, the LCC Library's ambient spaces are available to the public for work, study, or quiet personal projects. In addition, those with memberships at collaborating libraries are free to check out materials from the LCC Library's collections. For more information, visit lcc.edu/library.
Hi, I'm Melissa Kaplan, and I host a show called Galaxy Forum on LCC Connect. It's all about the creativity in our classrooms and on campus here at LCC and the connections we have with the community. You can catch Galaxy Forum here on LCC Connect or listen anytime at lccconnect.org.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of 3 children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a 5th grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a 5-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
By utilizing interactive activities, the Youth Summer Camp at LCC gives kids in grades 2 through 12 the chance to explore science, technology, engineering, arts, and mathematics. Scholarship opportunities are available. Details can be found at lcc.edu/seriousfun.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
This is Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, a podcast and radio program presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. Most any contemporary musical style can trace its roots back to the blues. Time Signatures explores the blues and its musical connections with captivating interviews, lively discussions, and news from the world of the blues.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, diving up in.
And now, here he is, your host, Jim Irvin.
Well, hi there, and welcome to Time Signatures. I'm your host, Jim Irvin. Now, I want you to imagine for a moment that you have the coolest gig around. Now, I don't care what it is. Just know that you're doing something that you love every single day. And let's toss in that you're also working with some legendary musicians while you're at it. Today's guest has such a job. He is stage manager and guitar tech for not only Buddy Guy, that position alone would be cool, but also working with another one of the hottest blues musicians on the planet, Christone Kingfish Ingram. I'm pleased to introduce you all to Connor Cordy. Connor, welcome to Time Signatures, man. How are you?
Doing good. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it. This is really cool.
Well, I'm glad to have you. I've seen your work a couple of times because I've gone to see Buddy twice now. And we're going to talk a little bit about that, but I want to start at the beginning for you, Connor. What influenced you to pursue this line of work to begin with, and how long ago did you get into it?
Well, I started guitar teching when I was in my early 20s. I worked at a music store, and I was the guitar manager and the in-house guitar tech. I worked alongside Fender and Gibson and Martin Taylor, even Orange. Nice. And like Rickenbacker. So, you know, being trained by them and having even just the reps come in and learning about the instruments and the woods and how the instruments are put together and all that good stuff, it piqued my interest. And Yeah, it kind of started from there. But, you know, even starting at 4 years old, I started playing guitar. So guitar has always been my go-to instrument. You know, out of all the instruments that are around in the world, that's the one thing that stuck with me. So being able to work at a music store and being around all these different guitars, vintage, new, you know, people bringing in guitars that were sitting in a closet for over two decades or something like that need to be cleaned up and worked on. It piqued my interest. And, you know, starting out touring, it wasn't specifically guitar teching. It was starting as a stagehand and then going into monitors and going into front of house and then, you know, including guitar teching in bands that I toured with. And then, you know, with this position with Buddy and my last two tours before this, it was starting going into the realm of instrument teching. So guitar, drums, whatever it may be. And I kind of went back full circle and went back to guitars. So that's kind of, you know, where it all started. But touring, you know, I started doing it around, I think I was about 21, 22, something like that. And now I'm turning 30. So close to 10 years. And it's been a ride for sure.
Talk about that first gig, knowing what was on the line, that first show when you started doing your touring. That had to be an absolute pressure cooker and event for you, yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, my first tour was with a major tour, I should say. You know, I've toured in vans and traveled with guys traveling around, and we were just doing gigs here and there in little bars. But my major tour, I was a monitor engineer for a guy named Masego. He's a, I wouldn't say rap, but more, he has his own genre. So it's like, he calls it trap house jazz. So there's saxophone, there's drums, there's guitar, there's bass, there's two background singers, the whole nine yards. And I was the monitor engineer for it. And that first gig was very, very scary, so to say, you know, big theater in Boston, starting out in Boston. And, full bus, full trailer, you know, stepping into a whole world that I had no idea what I was getting myself into. And I had a drumstick thrown at me that first show. Oh, no. So it was rough, but you know, you learn. I mean, that's the whole process. You know, someone gives you a chance and you run with it, and wherever it takes you, it takes you. And yeah, I mean, that first gig touring professionally was definitely stressful, for sure.
I can imagine. Now, look, I get it. You're a professional. You've got a ton of responsibility each day in your job. But be honest with me for a minute. Do you ever have a pinch me moment where you stand off stage watching Buddy and Kingfish and whomever you work with playing and taking care of their audience each evening?
You know, that moment, I joke around about this with a lot of people. That moment still hasn't hit me. I still haven't gotten the chance to sit back and realize what position I'm in. And it's not a selfish thing. It's more so, this is my line of work. And it's like anybody going to work every day. It's it's not like I'm sitting at an office job and being like, oh my God, I'm doing what I love to do. And this is, you know, I want to be an accountant or I want to be an insurance person or whatever. So being in the realm of touring, sure, there's some moments where I kind of sit back and I'm like, wow, this is crazy. But most of the time it's just my head's in the game and I'm watching the artist and I have to be on my toes at all times in case something happens. But you know, there, for instance, a moment that comes to mind is meeting Carlos Santana and having him tickle my ear, watching coming on stage to watch, Buddy Guy play at the New Orleans Jazz Festival, which is memorable, you know, and
yeah.
You know, surprising me, you know, Greg, Buddy's son, tickles my ear and I look over on this side and there's Carlos Santana, you know, laughing and, you know, because I was so focused. I mean, it's just, It's crazy. I mean, my the dreams that I've had that I wouldn't even imagine coming true, you know, and they do. And still haven't gotten the chance to just sit back and realize what I do for a living is, it's crazy. Crazy line of work for sure.
Yeah. Well, I have to imagine that your work with Buddy is bittersweet, especially knowing that this is the damn right farewell tour. Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. Yep. Absolutely.
Now, go ahead.
Farewell. You know, who knows what will happen next year or so on and in, into the future, but it's bittersweet. Absolutely. With Buddy for sure.
Well, I know that they've been talking that he's still going to do his residency and in Chicago at Legends, which is cool. But when he's not on the road and you don't have another gig, what do you do? Do you work at Legends as well and do some things there?
So initially I started running sound at Legends. That's kind of how I got my not foot in the door, but just being around the family and working around Buddy. That's kind of where it all started. But, you know, I haven't run sound there since I started being on the road with Buddy. So it's been a while. Probably like a year and a half ago, I got called in to just cover somebody. But, you know, when I'm not on the road and touring, of course, I'll go down and see Buddy and hang out with him and shoot the crap with him. But, you know, most of the time I'm either spending time with, you know, my loved one or being in the studio and producing records. That's kind of where I've piqued my interest the most, for sure.
Very cool. Now, take us into your daily work if you can, Connor. I've seen you prep the stage for Buddy twice now, and it's a nonstop. I mean, I've watched you work. But this time around, a couple of weeks ago, I paid special attention as you did your work, and you really have a lot to get done before you take before he takes a stage. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and there's a lot to do before. I mean, even prepping for Buddy is a lot. So my day to day routine is, you know, get up. We're on our bus, so we get to the hotel. We drop our luggage off. You know, we usually get to the hotel the day of. Or if we, you know, we have a day off before, we'll be there the night before, but let's say we're driving in and it's a show day. We drop our luggage off. We probably have about 30 to 45 minutes before we have to get back on the bus and head to the venue. So I, drop my stuff off, get back on the bus, head to the venue, get to the venue. We have to, you know, check everything, you know, check the venue, check the layout of the stage. And my main job, you know, as stage manager, is making sure we have a clear pathway for cases to run through. How many stagehands we have, you know, sure. what are their qualifications? Are they even qualified? Because most of the time, I mean, it's a hit or miss with some of these stagehands. So, you know, talking to the production manager, talking to the GM, even sometimes, talking to the stage manager of the club or the venue, and then looking to see, you know, what route for even a walkout for Buddy, you know, making sure a riser is set up and placed where it needs to be. And then it's head to the trailer and dump at 1 o'clock. And, you know, I'm there with our lighting guy, who's also the drum tech, Eli. So he's in the trailer with me dumping. And then Sage, our production manager, monitor engineer, is on stage kind of pointing kind of where cases all need to go. Max is either on stage or kind of dealing with Max, who's our tour manager, is kind of in front of house engineer dealing with, you know, getting green room set up and getting all that stuff situated. Dump the trailer. As soon as the trailer's closed, I run in to the back to the bus to grab Buddy's guitar, because we keep his main guitar on the bus with us just for temperature control and for safety, really.
Sure.
So grab that and then go in the club, put the guitar on stage right, go to my guitar amps and get hands and tell them what they need to do and start setting up. And then once everything's set up and ran and you know, get my world set up, and we do sound check. Band comes in, we do sound check. After sound check, either we have an opener or it's Tom. And if it's Tom, the drummer, and he does the opening set, then I could take down the carpet and you know, get everything else ready to go. If it's not Tom, then we got to take the carpet up. We got to take the monitors up. We got to take all the cables up. And then, you know, I go into after sound check, and whether or not we have to move stuff around, I got to set up Buddy's guitars. And, you know, the process of Buddy's guitars will take me about 35 to 40 minutes, maybe even longer, depending on what happens.
Wow. Yeah.
And even with stretching strings, getting it to my comfortability and changing batteries and, you know, getting Guitar World just set up in general. And then I got to get Buddy's mugs, you know, his cognac mugs cleaned and get towels. He needs 2 damp towels. So, you know, to get his finger, to get whatever's on his fingers off and have a nice grip on the pick. I got to get everyone else stage towels and waters with the labels ripped off of them, because, you know, unfortunately with pictures, endorsements and all that other stuff, that's just something I've been trained to do, is just take the labels off of the waters. And then, and then I have a security meeting. So I have a security meeting with all the security, and the production manager. So kind of go through the walkthrough and kind of Buddy's routine throughout the show. As well as talk about photos and you know, unfortunately with the world we live in, active shooter and, you know, fire and kind of Buddy's routine of, as soon as he gets off stage, he's gone. I mean, he does the ticket around, make sure he gets in his runner's car and he's good to go, and making sure I have enough security personnel when I'm out in the audience. And then it's showtime. And then, you know, there might be time where I have enough time to go in my bunk and maybe take a 30-minute cat nap, or, you know, even just get something to drink or eat or whatever. You know, there's that time period where I can do that. And then showtime and or changeover, really. It's either, you know, I got to throw down the rug. I got to tape the rug all the way around and make sure he doesn't trip. I got to tape the cables running from the back of the amps to the front of the monitors, tape all that stuff up. And then spike all of it really with bright neon tape so that he can see where the cables are so he doesn't trip.
Sure.
Because the way he walks, it's not somebody, he's 88. So the way he walks, not picking up each foot, it's sometimes he drags his feet. So, you know, just making sure that he's got a clear stage. And if there are cables, they're taped down and spiked. And then turn on the amps and turn on our rack and just, you know, tune the guitar, stretch the strings. I'm still stretching. I mean, even at the opener, I'm over there stretching the strings because Buddy's a hard player. So,
yeah.
Then once all that's done, amps are there. I fill his coffee mug up with a little bit of cognac, put that out there, make sure he's got tissues, make sure he's got, you know, baby powder ready to go on the side of the stage. Turn on the guitar, play a little bit, and just make sure I'm getting noise. Go up to the amps, kind of go between each amp to make sure that there's no issues with them. And then turn the guitar all the way off, volume knob off, tone all the way up on the neck pickup. I got 5 minutes, and, you know, the 5 minute mark is where I go down and get Buddy and let him know, knocking the door. Hey, you got 5 minutes. And then he either tell me I'll be right out or I'm ready to go. And we hit the stage, and as soon as we hit the stage, you know, I have my flashlight with me. Depending on if we're at an outdoor venue, I might keep the guitar in the Guitar World guitar vault so that temperature changes don't mess up the strings and they go out a lot of tune and all that other stuff. But if we're in a venue and it's the temperature is the same throughout the entire building, then I'm no worries, but I'll bring the guitar with me. And then we walk to stage and I take baby powder, put it on Buddy's hands. One of his hands, he holds out like this, put a little bit in here. He shakes it and then rubs it on his finger on his fingers. And then I give him a damp paper towel. First I give a pick, and then I give him a damp towel that he takes with his pick hand and rubs on the towel so he gets a better grip on his fingers. And then I either give him a tissue so he can blow his nose, or a sip of cognac, and then it's radio showtime, and then off he goes.
Very cool.
A lot. It is a lot of work. That's my day-to-day routine.
And just when you think the prep work is done, Now the real work begins, because you are in charge of making sure that the guitars keep going to him as he changes or needs, correct?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, most of the time he plays one guitar, and most, if not all the time, he plays one guitar. Occasionally I might surprise him with a polka dot and he'll be like, okay. And I tell him, if you don't like it, then you can give it back and I'll give you back your guitar that you're really comfortable with.
Right.
But yeah, keeping an eye on him is really the main thing, to make sure that he's safe on stage and comfortable and, you know, has no issues. And he's always asking me, you know, how much time he has left. And I have a countdown clock right by me that lets me know, hey, I started as soon as that intro music hits, and I'll let you know, whatever time, if you ask me how much time I got left, I'll let you know. So it's really very just kind cool of keeping him comfortable.
You know, I was, backstage momentarily when I arrived at the theater in Kalamazoo a couple of weeks ago. And I remember one of your coworkers backstage telling me that you're like a stage manager, Buddy's luthier, a sound tech. He said, you literally do it all. Mm-hmm. And I mean, watching how you work with him, and I've seen you interact with him and taking a guitar out to him and, you know, wait, looking for, you know, bad cables, broken strings, whatever. You're the guy. You're the guy no matter what. At the end of the day, it's your responsibility to make sure that everything flows perfectly for him. And so you work with Buddy, you work with Kingfish. Any other notable musicians or bands that you've worked with since you started, and any favorites along the way?
You know, in my career, I've worked with a lot of musicians, but Buddy and Kingfish are like my go-to. I mean, they're my favorite so far. Excuse my voice. I got allergies, so I'm like constantly clearing my throat.
Completely understand, man. Same here.
Buddy for sure. I mean, he's taken me places I've never even thought I'd be. But I've worked with, for instance, bands, you know, starting out doing little bars here and there, opening up for even big musicians, playing in amphitheaters and arenas and you know, things like that. And nothing compares to this, because even if it's just Buddy himself, but it's the camaraderie of crew. I mean, crew and other band members. I mean, we're a family. So this for sure is the tippity top of my career, of level, I guess, of touring. But I've worked with a band called Black Pistol Fire. I've worked with a band called Rah Rah Riot. I was with Masego. I was with the band called Super Organism, Brother Elsie. And then there's other garage bands or whatnot. But
right.
And Buddy and Kingfish. So it's just moved on down the line, you know.
Well, Connor, with all this excitement in your daily work life, what does a day off look like for you? Because I know you get precious few of them in the touring community. Uh-huh. It looks like your calendar is pretty busy. I think you told me you had a 5-day stretch here. Yep. Well, what do you do to decompress from the road, man?
Well, let's say I have an off day on the road in general. Usually what I'll do is I'll hit up Dan, our keyboard player, who's like one of my best buds on the road, and Sage and Eli, and we go out to eat, or we go see a movie, or we just take the day to ourselves and we just relax. You know, sometimes you just need that alone time. But on my days off, you know, off the road and being home, it's more so either, you know, spending time with my girlfriend, or flying down to Austin to spend time with my family, who currently just moved back down there. Or, you know, being in the studio and producing musicians and working on albums for younger musicians that, you know, that are coming up in the blues realm, and you know, creating a record label of my own and
nice,
creating incredible music for decades to come. So it's a hit or miss. I mean, my days, I kind of plan my days out, but I kind of don't. I kind of just kind of see where things go.
Well, I think that, and correct me if I'm wrong, because your life is so structured during that touring time, it probably feels nice not to have everything locked in and buttoned up, right?
Sometimes. I think anybody in the tech realm, or even, you know, any position in touring, it's kind of nice to have structure. You know, you have master tour on your phone, and you can look at your schedule, and it tells you exactly where you're going to be and what time things are. And then you get home and it's like, okay, it's already 5 o'clock. Should I go eat dinner? Should I, you know, it's adjusting. So it's just adjustment, but
sure.
You know,
well, Connor, looking back over your incredible career thus far, could you imagine doing anything else?
I went to school for audio engineering at Columbia College here in Chicago. I always wanted to be, you know, on tour. I mean, that's kind of my dream, was to be on tour, even when I was younger. You know, going to see people like Peter Frampton or AC/DC, sure, or anybody of those genres. Seeing them live and seeing the crew work and being like, man, that's what I want to do. Oh, there's a bus. Oh, they're all, you know, behind stage. And that's just what I wanted to do, is be on tour. But guitar teching is something it was not just an option. It was another avenue, because in our line of work, you have to have other skills and other,
sure,
to be an asset to other different positions. So, you know, wanting to be a front of house engineer, that's kind of like where I wanted to be. But I'm totally happy being a guitar tech. I'd much have rather be on stage and not have the pressure of, let's say, 50 or 5,000 people and the sound goes out or something happens.
Oh.
And I'd rather have one person mad at me than...
Connor, any special moments that you care to talk about? I mean, I can imagine you've had some really cool things happen along the way already, but I just got to ask.
Yeah. You know, a couple instances, taking a private jet to do the Jim Irsay experience, which was incredible. I mean, I would never even imagine getting on a private jet, let alone twice. You know, I've done it 2 times. And meeting just incredible musicians that I've listened to over the years. You know, Billy Gibbons and Carlos Santana and...
Yeah, tell that story, man, we were talking about before we went to air.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean,
I didn't mean to interrupt you. You've got to share that story. It's wonderful.
Yeah. So New Orleans Jazz Fest with Carlos Santana. We were opening up for him the last time we played there. Buddy was on stage, and, you know, Carlos Santana and Buddy are very close friends. You know, I'd met Carlos in the green room and getting Buddy and brought him on stage. Buddy's playing, you know, I'm stretching strings on his yellow and purple polka dot guitar, and I feel a tickle. Was it on, I think, on this ear? And that was Buddy's son Greg. He tickled my ear, and I look this way, there's nobody there, so I thought somebody was playing a joke on me, right? I look over this way, and there's Carlos Santana smiling at me. And, you know, he rubbed my back and he was like, oh, I'm just kidding. And then he walked and he watched Buddy play the entire set. You know, and Carlos Santana's people are so nice. You know, Tim Mack, who's Carlos's guitar tech, was so generous and so kind. His whole camp is super kind. You know, they put a chair out. I was watching Carlos the entire set, you know, and yeah, it was just an incredible experience, man. I mean, that's something, you know, I have a video of somebody who's sitting kind of behind us in like the viewing area, and they took a video of it. And I, like, still to this day, it's,
oh wow,
it's crazy. It's crazy.
Yeah. Well, listen, if there's anyone out there that's looking to hire an incredibly talented stage manager down the way, I know you're busy right now, But where would somebody go to get information about Connor Cordy?
Yeah, so you can go on Instagram, K-O-R-T as in Tom, E. That's where you can find me there. And then Facebook, Connor Cordy, K-O-R-T-E there too as well. C-O-N-N-O-R, not an E. Yeah, you can find me in those two places. Also, if you wanted to watch vlogs of touring for us on for Buddy Guy, you can look up Buddy Guy Crew Vlogs on YouTube. There's nice. Tons of videos out there of us on the road that I've filmed over our years of going to Australia or Europe or even in the States. So,
well, Connor Cordy, my sincere thanks for taking some of your free time to chat with me. That's not been lost on me. I want you to know that. But thank you so much for joining me today on Time Signatures. And continued good luck to you, sir.
Thank you, sir. I appreciate you.
All right. Well, I appreciate you too. That wraps up this edition of Time Signatures with Jim Irvin. Once again, my deepest appreciation to Connor Cordy for being here with us today. But more importantly, I want to thank you for being here, because if it wasn't for you being here and listening and paying attention and watching, none of this would be possible. And please do me a favor and make sure you subscribe to our channel as well. Jim Irvin reminding you that keeping the blues alive is everyone's responsibility, but preserving the history of the blues one story at a time is my mission. Until next time, so long.
This has been Time Signatures with Jim Irvin, presented by the Capital Area Blues Society in Lansing, Michigan. For more information on CABS, visit capitalareablues.org. You can find this episode and past episodes at lccconnect.org. The Time Signatures theme song, Michigan Roads, is used by permission and was written by Root Doctor, featuring Freddie Cunningham.
You know I'm crying, crying, baby, driving up in
Until next time, keep on keeping the blues alive.
Baby, I'm home.
Examining the issues and topics that affect our lives from the local level to the world stage. Listen to the programs of LCC Connect anytime at lccconnect.org.
LCC
Connect.
Voices.
Vibes.
Vision.
K-12 Operations at Lansing Community College is a proud collaborator of the Mason Promise Scholarship. The Mason Promise Scholarship is a community organization of volunteers that guarantees funding for 2 years of Lansing Community College education to selected Mason Public School students. For more information on the Mason Promise Scholarship at LCC, please visit lcc.edu/hope.
Hey parents, finding it hard to communicate with kids in today's world of ever-changing slang?
Hi son.
Excuse me?
Introducing the Communicizer. Just strap non-toxic Communicizer to your mouth and go from boring old man speak.
Oh, you know, I'm here if you want to talk.
To 100% off the chain.
Text me whenever, yo.
It's that easy.
Thanks to Communicizer, I'm relevant to my kids again. I mean, a fly, boo.
And now when you buy Communicizer, you get the auto-tune attachment free. Sounds so hip-hop, your kids will want to talk to you for hours.
I used to have to walk 3 miles uphill to school every morning, shorty.
I love you, Dad.
I love you too, son.
Communicizer is not available in stores because it doesn't exist. But that's okay. You don't have to be perfect to be a perfect parent. Because kids in foster care don't need perfection. They need you. For more information on how you can adopt, go to AdoptUsKids.org. A public service announcement from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, Adopt Us Kids, and the Ad Council.
The Job Training Center at Lansing Community College provides 2-month job training opportunities that are free to eligible participants. Training courses range from information technology to administrative assisting. For more information, visit lcc.edu/JTC training.
This has been a presentation of LCC Connect, a weekly program that features the voices, vibes, and vision of Lansing Community College. All shows featured on LCC Connect are recorded at the WLNZ studio, located on LCC's downtown campus. Each program is podcast-based and can be heard anytime at lccconnect.org. If you or someone you know would like to be a guest on one of our shows, connect with us by emailing lcc-connect@lcc.edu.